Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Myelofibrosis. And this is a two-part series, and today's focus is on overview of myelofibrosis, current treatment options, and quality of life concerns. And this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, as well as the MPN community, the MPN Education Foundation, the MPN Research Foundation, and the MPN Advocacy Organization. So we really have partnered with all of you to reach as many of you as possible on the call. And we actually have on the call today over 622 participants, and you really are from all over the United States, and you are on this call because of your, of course, interest in the topic, and you obviously are information seekers. You want to get as much information as possible. The majority of you are from the United States, from different parts of the U.S., all the different states, but we do have international participants as well from Australia, India, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. I'd like to point your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is information about our speakers and the topics they'll be covering. And there also is information about all of our different collaborating organizations as really resources for all of you, as organizations that you can call for help and support and their free services. Also, there is an evaluation form, and I would ask you all to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form. You know, your feedback is so important to us so that we come up with programs that are most helpful to you. Indeed, the topic for today's program and this whole series was one that you have all requested in previous programs we've done. So we take your recommendations very seriously, and we are planning a lot of programs for next year, so please tell us what you want us to do, and we'll try very hard to do it. This activity was made possible by the Insight Corporation. I really want to thank them for their support of this our program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on this workshop, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker is Dr. Ruben Mesa. Dr. Mesa is consultant hematologist, Mayo Clinic in Arizona. He is chair, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, and Deputy Director, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine. It's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Mesa.
Good afternoon. It's a great pleasure to be once again on this conference call regarding myelofibrosis. And my goal today is to try to give an overview of myelofibrosis, discuss some of the current therapies and upcoming clinical trials, and also some points of suggestion or advice as you work with your healthcare team, some things we've picked up along the way. Well, myelofibrosis is a myeloproliferative neoplasm. So what does that mean? It's a disease with a bit of a confusing name. Myelofibrosis literally means scarring in the bone marrow, but we've learned over time that myelofibrosis most accurately is thought of as a bone marrow disease and as one of the chronic leukemias. Now, not to make it sound more frightening or to confuse it with a more aggressive cousin of acute leukemia, but as a chronic leukemia, it's a disease that is both serious and can impact patients in a variety of ways. We know it's a disease that can, one, give a lot of symptoms. It can give night sweats, fatigue, weight loss. It's a disease that can interfere with how well the bone marrow works and can lead, because of that, to problems with anemia, too few red blood cells, or low platelets, or even low white blood cells. And finally, it's a disease that can lead to enlargement of the spleen. The spleen's a filter for the blood under the rib cage, and in some individuals can be very large. Now, why does the enlargement of the spleen matter in this disease? Well, the organ is a bit of an innocent bystander, but when it is enlarged, it can cause discomfort. It can lead to people filling up early when they eat and add to them losing weight. It can lead to lower difficulties with blood counts. The symptoms matter because we've learned that they can clearly impact patients' quality of life, interfere with people living their lives as they wish to live, but also can put them at greater risk by making them more fatigued, more sedentary, giving them greater risk of pneumonia or other difficulties. The final component, the risk of low blood counts, is important because, one, it can add to people not having as much energy as we wish, and two, can predispose, if the counts are low enough, to risk of infection or bleeding. Finally, as a chronic leukemia, there is a risk that the disease can progress to acute leukemia. Now, how do we look at the therapy of myelofibrosis? Well, it's a therapy that is rapidly evolving in many ways. Fundamentally, it falls into three categories when we visit with a patient with myelofibrosis. Should we observe the disease? In other words, not use a medical therapy. Should we use medicines? Or should we use bone marrow transplantation? So to decide which of these is most appropriate, we consider many factors. We consider how the patient is impacted with the disease. We consider the risk they have with the disease. How likely is the disease to be life-threatening? But also, what is the burden that they face? We also have to weigh in their other medical problems, their age, and their strength. Now, taking all three of those groups, observation, that is a group that continues to shrink over time. As we have better and better therapies, and we have therapies that hopefully slow the progression of the disease down, we still recognize that there are some people that are found to have myelofibrosis very early. They have no symptoms. Maybe they're very young. And some of these patients are best served by just watching the disease for the time being, and that some of them can have the disease for many years before it becomes a problem. Unfortunately, the majority of people are not in that category and are more significantly affected by the disease. So we divide them between those seeking bone marrow transplant and those who receive medicines. Now, bone marrow transplant, put in a nutshell, is a therapy that can cure myelofibrosis. But it's quite a complicated therapy. It's probably one of the most complicated medical procedures a patient can undergo. With several months of fairly intensive medical care, a good chunk of which can occur in the hospital, but also a risk that comes with that procedure. The decision of whether an individual should go through a bone marrow transplant and when is a complex one to discuss with your healthcare team, and it depends on many things, including an individual's age, their risk with the disease, who potentially could be the bone marrow donor, as well, and importantly, an individual's wishes. Now, most individuals fall into that middle category of medicines, and medicines can have both short-term and long-term goals. In the short term, there are many goals that we have, and it depends on how the individual is affected. If an individual has difficulties with many symptoms from the disease, night sweats, fevers, weight loss, itching, fatigue, and they have enlargement of the spleen, we have seen well that the class of medicines that we call JAK2 inhibitors have been very effective for this group of individuals. There is now an FDA-approved drug in this class, ruxolitinib, or the trade name of Jakafi, and there are several others that are testing as JAK2 inhibitors, including SAR-302503 from Sanofi-Aventis, momelotinib, or CYT387, pacritinib, which is SB1518, so several that are testing along these lines. Second, we try to improve anemia. All of the JAK2 inhibitors sometimes can help anemia. There is data suggesting CYT387 may have a bit more impact on anemia, but that's still undergoing testing in clinical studies. Other drugs that have been helpful in this setting are erythropoietin or Procrit, medicines such as danazol or androgens, and the class of medicines in the family of thalidomide. Thalidomide, lenalidomide, even pomalidomide have been beneficial on this aspect. Additional medicines that can be used will be in certain circumstances. So there are times we have used radiation to the spleen, if other medicines are not being helpful. There are times we have surgically removed the spleen. In the current era, typically only if medical therapy or JAK2 inhibitors have not been effective. Now, we've made great advances over these past few years with the rapid development of several drugs for myelofibrosis, including the JAK2 inhibitors, the drugs like pomalidomide, and other drugs. Now, in the past, these drugs have been tested by themselves, trying to demonstrate their individual benefit. As we try to move forward in the future, we recognize that clinical trials are essential, where we try to use either medicines by themselves or in combinations to try to further improve how effective they are for you as a myelofibrosis patient. So these clinical trials fall in different categories. Now, clinical trials are just a structured way for you to get a treatment, for us to see what is the impact and be able to compare that to others so that both we learn, but that other patients with myelofibrosis will benefit from the experience that you've had, whether that be a helpful experience or not in the future. Now, at the current time, there are many clinical trials for myelofibrosis, probably more than there have ever been at any point in history. So a tremendous effort internationally to try to improve the options for myelofibrosis patients. There are many trials that are going on still testing drugs by themselves. So single JAK2 inhibitors, whether it be SAR302503 or other JAK2 inhibitors such as NS018, pacritinib, LY2784544. There are other single-agent studies in myelofibrosis trying to impact the disease. Interferon in early myelofibrosis, led by Dick Silver, to try to decrease the rate of progression. There are drugs trying to target other enzymes, such as histone deacetylase, or other components that may help to slow the progression of the disease down. Next, there's combination studies, many with the FDA-approved drug of ruxolitinib, to see if there can be better outcomes. Combinations along with drugs that might help improve anemia, combinations that precede bone marrow transplantation, and combinations with other drugs that might be active, whether they be drugs that help to block scarring, such as with the Gilead drug GS6624, or the Prometeor drug PRM151. So there's never been a greater time of intensity of testing new therapies for myelofibrosis. Now, can I tell you which of these is best? I wish I knew. We clearly are trying to find which of these are the most effective. These trials very much are occurring in parallel, so we really cannot answer yet which option is best for one individual or the other. Now, what I've described for you is a really complicated journey that you find yourself on, and a journey that needs a lot of support. Support from your family, from your caregivers, from your loved ones, and support from your healthcare team. Now, with your healthcare team, it's very important that you have a good line of communication, that they fully understand the disease that you have, that they understand the difficulties that you face, that they understand the symptoms that you face with the disease. And as you start a new therapy, many things are observed. Does it have an impact on your blood counts? And if so, is that favorable or not favorable? If the goal is to improve your symptoms and the size of your spleen, do those improve? If you have side effects from the medicines, are they side effects that are ones that will diminish over time? Are there side effects that might be able to be helped with some additional supportive medicines? Some of these medicines can cause occasional nausea when we begin the therapy, but frequently we find that that will go away over time if we stick with the medicine. Interferon is an example of another medicine that at first can give flu-like symptoms, but over a few weeks typically can diminish and the individual end up feeling better. So there's importance in terms of communication in terms of counts, important in terms of communicating with your team whether when your next visit should be, when you should be monitoring your blood counts. If you're an individual that has more significant problems with anemia what is the threshold for transfusion and how frequently should you be transfused, but also an important to have the shared expectation. If you are on a medical therapy, what are the expectations? Are you on a medical therapy that we should expect it to improve anemia or not? Is it a therapy that should be changing the bone marrow or not? Is it a therapy that we hope that has the potential of cure, such as bone marrow transplant? Or is the goal of a therapy to aid in your quality of life and help improve overall how you feel? The final component is communicating with friends, with family, with loved ones, with caregivers, even with sometimes your employer. Myelofibrosis is a complicated disease, and that's why Carolyn Messner and others who are very active, such as Cancer Care, to help with patient education, create programs such as this so that other individuals can learn about your disease, so that you can use this as a resource for helping to explain directly to others involved what's involved with your disease. I have tried to put out, as my colleagues have, many YouTube videos or other resources to try to provide a resource for individuals to try to best understand this complex disease and see where an individual fits within that disease and some of the special challenges that they face. So I'm hopeful that this call and the wonderful talks you'll be hearing subsequently from Dr. Tvrtchevchuk and Ms. Mezovitz will act as a resource for you and help you in some way along your journey. And with that, I will hand the call back to Carolyn and our next speaker.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Messer. That was really just a wonderful presentation, very informative and comprehensive. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Serdan Verstovzek. And Dr. Verstovzek is Chief Section for MPN, Myeloproliferative Neoplasms, the Leukemia Department, Clinical Research Center for MPN, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Verstovzek is going to address reducing complications of myelofibrosis, symptom and pain management, the importance of follow-up care, and how research contributes to treatment options. It's now my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Verstovzek.
Thank you, and I really appreciate giving me opportunity to join you again for this wonderful educational event. To continue in what Dr. Ruben Mesa has summarized in excellent way, I would start with a description of what is actually clinical need when we see a patient with a myelofibrosis in our clinics. Dr. Ruben Mesa has outlined that we usually assess the patients in terms of their need for intervention because, unfortunately, apart from the bone marrow transplant at the moment, we don't have a medication that would be eliminate disease and cure the patient from myelofibrosis. Again, this is only possible with the use of bone marrow transplant. So there are occasional patients that have a disease, but the disease does not cause major harm to a person, and we do observe such a patient. But majority of the patients do have a need to intervene, and the issues that are usually identified by the physicians that treat the patients with myelofibrosis are usually of three different scopes. And the first one is the enlargement of the spleen, which is usually very big in about 80% of the patients, followed by enlargement of the liver in about 40% of the patients. And there are many problems that come with these enlargements, including mechanical discomfort in the body with the GI tract, pain on its own from the enlargement, infarction in the spleen that can exacerbate the problem, early satiety adding to cachexia and overall body wasting. The enlargement of the spleen as well can contribute to lowering of the blood cell count, particularly platelets and red blood cell count. The second indication for therapy is significant anemia. Usually this is defined as hemoglobin less than 10, which happens perhaps in about a third of the patient to the extent that patients require frequent transfusions. Overall, everybody would develop significant anemia over time, but about a third would require frequent transfusions. And when the anemia is clinically significant, it requires intervention. And number three would be a significant constitutional symptoms. That would be including body aches and pains, night sweating, itching, sweating, body wasting, and others. We usually intervene with the medications that would counteract those three. And we were able to, as described by Dr. Mesa previously, at this time to develop medications that go in a class of JAK inhibitors that counteract in majority of the patients to great extent the problems with the organomegaly, the enlargement of the spleen and liver, and counteract significantly constitutional symptoms, body aches and pains, itching, sweating, weight loss, and others. This benefit lasts in majority of the patients for a very long period of time. We have medications that we use off-label that target anemia, like thalidomide that was mentioned, or chemotherapeutic agents like hydroxyurea, or even splenectomy that we can use for enlargement of the spleen. And one in everyday setting can combine these efforts to benefit the patients the most. If we ask the patients what is the main problem with the disease, it comes really down to terrible symptoms that this disease comes with. And they are usually seen in terms of not just related to the big organs, but again, fever, weight loss, night sweating, fatigue, weakness, overall body deterioration, and unfortunately, decrease in performance status. We try to affect all of this at once, and at the moment, we are engaged in multiple new studies that would help bring the best out of a new knowledge in biology that we have acquired over the last 5 to 6 years about myelofibrosis. The speed of discovery is fast, but never too fast, as I usually say, and we do need to involve other specialists in our care. Particularly, I want to put an example of our colleagues that counteract and try to control symptoms and overall pain that comes with the disease related to big organs, but also related to the body aches and pains. And this would highlight the need for team effort in everyday management of the patients with advanced myelofibrosis. In addition to the pain specialist that would help with the management of the pain, we also, for example, here at MD Anderson have a fatigue clinic. Almost everybody with advanced myelofibrosis have significant fatigue. So having a team effort, having a specialist that would work together to bring the best in medical arena to a patient for better, for improvement in quality of life and improvement in the longevity of the patients is the usual goal. This is also to highlight the importance of the follow-up care, because one can best know what the problem is and how problems develop in a single individual by learning what are the changes that the person experiences over time, what is the patient's problems that happen, at what pace. So trend in a change is very important to grasp from frequent follow-ups and being involved in the care of the patient with myelofibrosis over a prolonged period of time to best grasp the problems, to best identify the problems and direct the team effort in improving those issues. We cannot underemphasize the importance of patients' support groups because of the nature of the disease that affects not just the blood count, as usually the blood and bone marrow diseases do, but the whole body. It is unfortunate how the disease can debilitate a particular person. And apart from a team effort on the medical side, it is also important to engage with the support groups, with the patient support groups, and I have an example here, actually, in Texas, where the patient support group has been organized by the patients themselves. Patient education is a very important part provided by all involved individuals that I described, because the improvements can only be done if we work together. Finally, it would be also important, as Dr. Ruben Mesa has identified in his talk, participation of our patients along the lines of research efforts to identify new important medications that can help patients counteract the problems that we still did not address. JAK inhibitors, for example, are very good, as I described, in counteracting big organs and poor quality of life. We can provide significant benefits for a long period of time, but we need to improve those benefits further for majority of the patients. We can add medications that can perhaps improve the anemia. We can test new medications that would eliminate fibrosis from the bone marrow and find proper combinations for markedly better improvement in the signs and symptoms of the disease and perhaps even elimination of the disease with the medications without the bone marrow transplant at the end. This is our ultimate goal, and a lot of effort has been put in this on by everybody involved, including the industry that is developing the medications, physicians, and the patient community. And I'd like to thank everybody for joining today and contributing in spreading the knowledge about myelofibrosis. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Vistovcek. And actually, this whole program is being done during the period of myelofibrosis awareness time, so I just wanted to let everyone know that as well. But this will go on throughout the year, and we hope that you will actually use this information. And it was an excellent presentation, Dr. Vistovcek, and I know that there are many questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Carly Mesovitz, and Carly is an oncology social worker, and she will be, and she is actually at Cancer Care. And Ms. Mesovitz will be describing the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care and also the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Mesovitz.
Thanks so much, Carolyn. It's really a pleasure to be part of this call today. So Drs. Mesa and Vistovcek both talked a little bit about the importance of a support system. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about creating a support network when somebody's diagnosed with myelofibrosis, as well as how Cancer Care can really be a strong part of that network. There are a lot of ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization, and we provide free professional support services to anyone affected by any type of cancer. Cancer Care programs include both individual counseling and support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are well trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are also experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling can be both empowering and encouraging. Adjusting to and really dealing with the diagnosis is such an important part of the healing process. Here at Cancer Care, we offer face-to-face support groups in our local offices in the New York area, as well as telephone and online groups, which are available and accessible for people across the country. These groups really offer an opportunity to talk with other people impacted by the same diagnosis or by similar situations, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker who will facilitate those groups. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. Group members offer a sense of encouragement and community that can provide you with additional support and guidance along the way. These connections help to lessen the isolation that so many people living with cancer experience. So if you're interested in learning more or participating in a Cancer Care support group, feel free to call our toll-free Hope line at 1-800-813-4673 to speak with an oncology social worker, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org for more information. And although we might not be able to resolve all of the problems that you're facing every day, Cancer Care social workers provide support, insight, and the ability to counsel you as you navigate your experience. So many people who are impacted by cancer find this to be a reassuring and comforting service that can help you feel less alone. So again, please contact us at 1-800-813-4673 or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work and support. I appreciate all of your time and attention, and thanks for the opportunity to talk with you all today.
Well, thank you so much, Carly, for that wonderful presentation in terms of the services that people can access from Cancer Care and the importance of getting this free support at this time. And now we have time for questions. I'm going to bring our speakers on board, and we're going to take as many of your questions as possible. And I'm going to ask that Stephanie explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. So, Stephanie, if you would let everyone know how to do that, and then we'll take as many of your questions as possible. If we are not able to answer your question or you think of a question after today's teleconference, then please actually go right ahead and, call us at our 800 number, and our social work staff will, of course, help you and help you to get the information you need. But for now, let's see how many of your questions we can take, okay? Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone.
And we do have a question from one of our online participants. Excellent question. The question is, does Jakobi only help with constitutional symptoms, or will it delay change to AML? Dr. Vistovzak, could you address that question?
Excellent question. JAK inhibitors control the activity of so-called JAK-STAT proteins that are highly active in the cells in the bone marrow of patients with myelofibrosis. With that, there are two aspects of how these medications work. They are providing like a stop sign for cells to stop growing, so that's why we see a significant reduction in the spleen and liver. And they are also providing anti-inflammatory benefit, which can be seen with the rapid resolution of systemic symptoms, the fevers, the night sweating. So it's a combination of the two aspects that we believe the ruxolitinib in particular, or Jakafi, works in patients with myelofibrosis. These benefits are seen in great majority of the patients and they last for a very long period of time. More recent reports also indicate that in some patients, about a quarter of the patients, and this is not published yet but presented in oral sessions at major hematology meetings 2 months ago, then in about a quarter of the patients, after 4 years on ruxolitinib, there is improvement in the bone marrow fibrosis to a degree. However, the therapy does not eliminate disease. So we say, and I usually try to explain in a simple way, that we, with these medications, control signs and symptoms of the disease, but we don't eliminate it. And with better control of signs and symptoms, particularly in patients with more advanced features, we can delay the progression and people can live longer. We don't usually eliminate the risk of disease transforming to acute leukemia. Unfortunately, that's not the benefit we have seen so far, so that risk does stay there.
And Dr. Vistovzak, this is actually from one of our online participants, from Sherry, and this is similar, it's almost a similar question, but I think there might be a slight nuance here, so I'm going to ask you this. It says, are there any indicators to watch for myelofibrosis converting to leukemia? A local doctor told us that it's natural progression, yet online it says only 15% of patients develop AML. Is that something that you could address in a general way? Any particular indicators
yes,
that people should?
So the information on the risk of a transformation comes from looking back in and seeing what happened with the patients that had a myelofibrosis that did transform to acute myeloid leukemia. And it is correct information that about 15 to 20 to 25% of the patients would transform from myelofibrosis to acute myeloid leukemia. Not everybody. So minority of the patients. The question is how to see or predict whether there is a risk in certain individual. And we usually look at these baby cells in blasts, baby cells called blasts, that we see in the blood and in bone marrow, and they can be elevated. And if they go beyond, let's say, 5, 10, or 15%, we would say that there is increased risk of a transformation to acute leukemia, because when the percent of these baby cells called blast is above 20%, then this is definition of acute myeloid leukemia, so the disease becomes more aggressive, and we call it acute leukemia. So looking at the blood count, or if necessary, looking at the bone marrow biopsy, is a way to look at it, but usually blood count is the simplest way of monitoring for this particular aspect. There are other biological markers that one can look for, but they are not usually routinely done. And by knowing the patients and emphasizing, from my part, this trend in change that I mentioned in my presentation early on, and knowing the patient and seeing significant changes would prompt one to question whether there is a transformation in process.
And so, and again, it's all a same, another question from Diane. It's a nuance to the, what you've already talked about, but is there genetic testing that can be done to know if you have a greater chance of progressing to AML? If so, how and where can this be done?
Okay. There are aspects of the testing that cover molecular testing. This is the genetic testing for the presence of the JAK2 mutation, for example, which we know does not really correspond at all to a risk of a transformation. There are other genetic testings that can be done, most of them in research laboratories, not in everyday practice, which are exploratory, and we don't really have a way of implementing them in everyday practice to guide us in decision-making. One test that is usually done in routine practice on the bone marrow sample, sometimes even on the blood, is so-called cytogenetics. It's a complicated name, but what it means is looking at the chromosomes, the finger-like structures that carry genes that are seen in the cells that divide. This is a cytogenetic testing that is done routinely on the bone marrow when you do the bone marrow biopsy. And if there are some abnormalities in chromosomes, these are usually connected to a perhaps more aggressive disease, but not universally. One needs to take this information if there are abnormalities along with all the other information that the patient comes with, including age and blood cell count and other aspects of the disease. So cytogenetic is one test that helps in looking at that. If there are abnormalities, they would say that the disease is a little bit more aggressive perhaps, or has a tendency to change, but it's not ultimate answer. There is no one test that would tell you, yes, you are at the risk or you are not at the risk. It's a combination of things.
And we have another question, a different about clinical trial, but the question is, with a clinical trial that is being run by a doctor, is there any way to have participation with a local hematologist-oncologist working with the trial doctor? I live in Maryland and can't travel to Minnesota, but I'm interested in a trial that's starting in October in Minnesota.
It's a challenging question in terms of how frequently you have to go back to the center running the clinical trial. I mean, Serge, myself, Ayelu Teferi, obviously, who's running the trial in question, you all recognize that it's difficult for patients to be traveling for trials. So there are certain limitations that both the Food and Drug Administration put on clinical trials, as well as the trial sponsors in terms of a minimum number of evaluations at the registering center, because the center, whether it's Mayo Clinic or MD Anderson or Northwestern or what have you, is ultimately responsible for the individual on the study. So local doctors clearly do participate in terms of checking labs in between visits, helping if there's challenges. But unfortunately, in most trials, there's no easy way for the trial to be conducted remotely based on all the limitations we face.
Okay. Thank you. So perhaps we could have a discussion between Dr. Vistovzak and Dr. Messer about the issue of really trial participation for people who really do have difficulties traveling or may not be near a site where a trial is taking place. Could you just comment on that? Because I think that that might be challenging for some people and perhaps not for others, but how is that usually dealt with? What kinds of recommendations can you make to people? Dr. Vistovzek, would you like to go first?
Yes. I think that Dr. Metzler has described the challenges that are imposed on anybody who is involved in the conduct of clinical research. The supervision of investigational studies is very tight with purpose. These are, after all, investigational studies, and no guarantees that they would work, and, of course, the safety first. And therefore, the studies are conducted usually in a limited number of centers where such a supervision and conduct can be guaranteed to a satisfactory level for those that supervise, like a Food and Drug Administration. This has a consequence, as you just mentioned, that not everybody can participate, and there are limitations on a patient's travel. Occasionally, but this is rather rare, there are studies where the sponsor of a study, a company that actually is in charge of this investigational medication, provides a support for patients' participation by providing funds for travel or hospital or hotel stay, and that has to be researched individually for each particular study by patients in question. Unfortunately, this is rare again. There is no easy resolution to the problem. I don't know what Ruben would say. Ruben?
Well, perhaps I'd add a couple things. One, certainly agree with everything Serge has mentioned. First, the availability of clinical trials is much broader now than it was when we first started. And at the beginning of my career, there were very few centers at all that did trials in myelofibrosis. Really, it was largely Mayo Clinic at first, and Serge was obviously transformational in terms of the increased experience of clinical trials at MD Anderson. But it certainly has expanded much beyond our two centers, and now with many clinical trials that are being conducted, they can be in many sites across the U.S. So it certainly has expanded, but it clearly is not in every center by any means. So there's much greater availability, but still we have those limitations. I would say, in addition to the trials sometimes providing support, there are other resources. Sometimes the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society has some limited funds that they are able to assist people traveling for clinical trials. I believe the American Cancer Society, similar, can have some help or assistance or support. And I think there are, and Carolyn may have additional information, but other philanthropic organizations that can help patients sometimes access resources that are not available elsewhere.
Well, that is true. That there are many of the organizations that are listed in the materials you all received do actually help with transportation and with some of the costs of treatment. But the logistics of, and the logistics actually of traveling, but it also, of course, a lot depends upon how you're feeling to be able to travel and to actually relocate sometimes for participating in the trial. Or is that, again, Dr. Messer and Dr. Vistovzek, is relocation necessary for a trial, or are some trials you can come periodically for the treatment and then go back to your home, or how does that usually, if you could say a little bit more about that?
So each study, yeah, Ruben, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's very study dependent, and perhaps I'll have Serge talk about in-town resources, is that I think MD Anderson does that in particular well for people that are staying long periods of time. Most of the studies in MPN, and I use those as an example because other studies that are very intensive, such as acute leukemia studies, briefly, we'll have to have people reside at an area for a period of time. But most MPN studies, you know, have visits that are at most every 2 weeks. It's rare that they are once a week. More frequently, they're once a month, and people travel by car or by plane typically for those interval visits. Yeah. Serge, why don't you tell them a little bit about, in terms of people who really stay for studies, both in MPN but the acute leukemia, what sort of resources both at MD Anderson and elsewhere they might be able to find?
So for MPN, we are fully aware of difficulties with the participation in the study. I should convey strongly that in designing the study, and the studies many times are designed together with the sponsor, the companies that provide those investigational medications, we always emphasize the need to relax the frequency of the visits for one to participate from far. And we get, I would say, people to recognize the need for that. And I should say that in the studies, we have for each particular instance the at least frequency employed as the sponsor would feel comfortable. So we recognize this and try to relax the frequency as much as possible. For those patients that are really from far away or have a more aggressive type of the disease and need to stay here for observation or participate in a study that require more frequent visits, there are supporting offices here in terms of social workers and case managers and financial office that help provide, for example, a list of places where there would be a significant discount for stay, would guide the patients to apply for financial support from national organizations or even from local organizations. We have to have, like I mentioned before, when we get to the medical therapy, we have to have this supporting system to work together as a team to make the best we can. And in large places where there are many patients of different kind, this support is being built and others follow suit. This is the best way of making progress.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Many of the larger institutions are able to do that. And Carly, do you want to comment on just that, the concept of people having to travel for treatment and some of the resources that are out there for them?
Absolutely. Traveling can be physically, emotionally exhausting for people, but it's important that they realize that there are resources out there. Cancer care can certainly be a source of support in helping to locate different programs that exist to help with both the financial expense related to transportation and lodging, but to also listen and support someone as they deal with the emotional impact of kind of picking up and relocating at times, or just the emotional impact that traveling back and forth can have on a person and their family. So we are certainly available to help on both those levels in any ways that we can. So we encourage people to reach out to us to help find those resources for them.
And that's an excellent point, actually, Carly, that, and also people have someone to talk with and kind of weigh the pros and cons and decide really what's going to work for them. It's a very individual decision made between the person and their physician and their family and those who care about them and an institution that they're planning to go to, so they have all the resources in place. So we now have mechanisms in place where you can actually talk these things out before you go, so as many things are taken care of as possible ahead of time. Excellent. Thank you. And now there's another question here from one of our online participants, from Jeffrey. With the progress of Jakafi and the new and coming JAK2 drugs, how does one decide whether to risk the morbidity and the mortality of bone marrow transplant versus staying on the JAK drugs? Dr. Vistovzak, could you address that?
This is an excellent question that we face all the time, because as we emphasize, the bone marrow transplant is the only curative intervention at this point in time for patients with myelofibrosis. With JAK inhibitors, we make people enjoy life fully for perhaps a longer period of time, but disease finds a way eventually to overcome the JAK inhibitor, and this is where we look for new investigational agents to be developed. It has to be individualized when we talk about this particular issue. We know that the transplant is done better in patients, or the success of a transplant is better in patients that are in better physical condition with smaller spleens. These are some negative prognostic factors for overall outcome. So with the development of the JAK inhibitors, as we mentioned, make people do better, gain weight, perform more. The spleens are smaller. And there is a general overall across the globe attempt to fully evaluate the use of JAK inhibitors and Jakafi in particular in pre-transplant setting, meaning that you do improve the patient's condition for a period of time, perhaps 3 months or 6 months, and then engage in a transplant when the patient is in best physical condition. On the other hand, of course, the patient feel better, and then the question is that the time for one to engage when the things are going well? I have seen many patients facing this dilemma in my clinic, and there is no easy answer one way or the other. It has to be taken all together on the individual basis, including the situation that the patient is otherwise with his or her health and the family situation, and what is actually the clinical situation with the patient. It is something that is being studied, but when we come to a decision, it is really individualized.
Yeah, I would add to that excellent discussion by Serge that it truly is a very challenging decision. Transplant is probably one of the most complex medical therapies a patient can undergo that truly is life-altering in many ways. It clearly can be curative, but it is a challenging road. And, you know, where that sits along an individual patient's journey, whether that be never, whether that be in the future, whether that be as soon as possible, is in part how they stand, in part the potential safety based on the donor, is in part how they respond to medications, perhaps, but also is important their own philosophy. I mean, I've had individuals who were, let's say, in the middle group, their mid-60s, who are not perfect candidates, but still candidates for transplant, and some who have certain views and goals and family support would choose to go toward transplant, and there's others in their exact situation who would choose not to go with transplant. So given it's such a complex decision, I do think that it is one that is helpful hearing multiple perspectives and sometimes multiple opinions on the issue of transplant because it is quite complex. There are some that have very strong opinions, either pro or con, for transplant, and I think that hearing probably some of each is helpful in that making that decision is not a simple matter.
That's an excellent. These are excellent points. I think the issues around decision-making is always very hard. Carly, do you want to comment on that just in some of the groups, how people struggle with those decision-making processes, really?
Sure. I think everyone experiences a different way in which they make decisions, but having an outlet like a support group or a counselor, social worker, someone to bounce ideas off of, to explore all of their options, can be really helpful and can give them a sense of clarity about what their needs actually are. Decision making is never easy, whether it's about treatment or the medical team that they decide to work with. So it's important that they have a space that they can really talk things out with, that they know that they have choices, that they have options, and that they can have a chance to consider how each different decision would impact their quality of life.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from Hetty online. When taking JAK medicine and the spleen and liver sizes decrease, where in the body are the blood cells being made? Dr. Mesa, could you address that, please?
Well, it's a good question, you know, and there's a lot of misperceptions in this area. What goes on in the spleen is we believe there is what we call ineffective blood creation. There are cells that go to the spleen. They can grow in the spleen, but not much useful is actually coming out of the spleen. And probably the strongest evidence we have for this is what we observe after someone has had their spleen removed. When people have had their spleens removed with myelofibrosis, we typically don't see that they have anemia. In fact, we typically see that their blood counts tend to increase. So there is this, there's fear that the spleen is actually making cells. It's not actually contributing very much to the blood supply as far as we can tell. Although the bone marrow has a lot of scarring, amazingly, the bone marrow still is able to keep up with the demand.
Excellent. And we have one last question from Sherry. Are MPN diseases hereditary? Should children of patients be tested if they have had mild anemia issues in the past? Dr. Vistovzak, would you address that, please?
Yes, this is really important. Many people, patients, come forward with this question, worrying about their family members. And we know that, like for some other common diseases, like blood pressure problem or diabetes, there is a certain predisposition in the families to develop different types of myeloproliferative diseases, not the same. But predisposition exists, like, again, for other perhaps more common and obvious conditions that we live with. But there is no real inheritance in a way that you will give it to somebody or you got it from somebody. So there is no testing necessary. There is no real need to worry about it because... if disease is to happen in somebody, it would be discovered, like in a given person, a patient, by a regular physical exam checkups that are conducted for everybody during their life. So the answer is no. There is no real need for examinations of particular kind, and there is no specific test that needs to be done.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank our speakers. You've been extraordinary, and I want to thank all of you who've queued up and really asked such incredible questions. And I know there are many more questions that you would like to ask, and I'm going to again suggest that you go ahead and call our 1-800-813-4673 phone number at Cancer Care, and our staff will be here to, of course, answer your questions. Most importantly, as we're about to conclude the program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with myelofibrosis, in coping with blood cancers. I want you to know that you're now part of this community of support and that we're here to help you. And you have a listing in your materials of many different organizations to call, Cancer Care being one of them. And we really welcome your calling. All of these organizations offer free support and services. There are all the MPN organizations as well that are listed that you can contact as well. There are a lot more resources now than perhaps ever before. Also, this is part one of a two-part series, so our second part of this program, coping with the stress of caregiving when your loved one has myelofibrosis, but we do open it to also people who are living with fibrosis themselves, on October 9th, 2013. Again, I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.